Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cellular Healing TV. I'm your host, Meredith Dykstra, and this is episode number 154. We have our resident cellular healing specialist, Dr. Dan Pompa, on the line, of course. And today we welcome special guest, Zach Bitter. And we have a treat for you guys because we're going to delve into something that we haven't talked a lot about on Cell TV yet. And we are going to dive into the world of fat-adapted athletes. So Zach has a very impressive resume here. And before we jump in, let me tell you a little bit more about Zach. Zach Bitter is an ultra marathon runner and coach at Zach Bitter Running. Zach specializes in a variety of ultra marathon racing and coaching, as well as a history of collegiate track and cross country, focusing heavily on nutrition and its role in training and recovery. Personally, he has had the most success following a higher fat diet, treating macronutrient intake the same way he periodizes training. A few of his notable accomplishments include a 12-hour world record of 101.7 miles, a 100-mile American record, and that was 11 hours and 40 minutes and 55 seconds, a 200-kilometer American record, 100-kilometer track American record. He's a three-time national champion and a three-time participant for Team USA at the World 100K Championships, and he's been in over 40 ultra marathon competitions. Wow, Zach, very impressive. Welcome to Cellular Healing TV.
Thanks a bunch for having me on. Looking forward to it.
Wow. Yeah. And listen, I'm fascinated by you. I think my wife said last night when I was reading more about you, you know, she said, "Wow, you're really impressed with this guy." I said, "You know, I'm impressed with anybody who does the ridiculous, that does the extraordinary." You know, and dude, I mean, that is what you've done. I mean, who runs 100 miles anyway, let alone in 11 hours and 40 minutes? So I'm like, is he doing this on a track? Is he doing it, you know, in the woods? I mean, where do you run 100 miles? I mean, I guess, is it both? I mean, I'm asking that question first.
Yeah, that's the goofiest thing about, I guess, the sport of ultra marathon running is really like any environment is fair game. And it can be as dialed as a track, or it can be as wild, I guess, as mountains and deserts and things like that. So the interesting thing to me with that is that when you're looking at distances of that range, like specificity is king in your training. So to train for a track 100 mile is quite a bit different than, say, training for a mountain 100 mile and the way you're going to go about the workouts and things like that.
Yeah. So I was reading, and I guess it was 2015, you set a record, and it was around the track, you know, and every 4 hours, you switch directions, right? It's like, and psychologically it helped you, but when you switch directions, you like, you know, it kind of destroyed your rhythm, if you will, and you kind of slowed down. I read the whole thing. I was fascinated. And then you at the end, literally the last 15 miles, I mean, you hit the wall. And you still kept going. I mean, at least what I read, I'm like, that dude hit the wall. I mean, your body was shutting down. You managed to still get the record. But I mean, the last 15 miles, you, in your words, said it was like an eternity. You know, I mean, that's unbelievable.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience for sure. It was a little different than I had actually done a similar attempt 2 years prior and kind of had an opposite experience in terms of I felt like I was kind of getting stronger near the end, whereas this time I was starting to cramp up a little bit in my hamstrings and my posterior chain. So when I finished the 100 miles, I was done. Yeah. It was interesting though the way it kind of played out. Like in a perfect world, I would have kept going for another 20 minutes and tried to break my 12-hour world record because I would have had roughly 20 minutes to go over 1.7 miles and get that. And I think I could have kept going had I had a 15-minute break and been able to get up and start going again once I kind of got control and stuff like that. But at that point, the time had elapsed. So I'll have to try to go back and see if I can better that one at a different time.
Just to break it down, I mean, essentially you're doing 4 marathons. So someone do the math for me. What is your average marathon time on these runs?
I think on that day, it was like right around a 303 marathon or somewhere in that ballpark.
Oh my God. I mean, imagine running 4 3-hour marathons. I mean, that's just unbelievable to me, honestly. And then, okay, for our viewers and our listeners' sake, you know, folks, he's doing it in a fat adapted state. And I would argue, you know, that's the best, most efficient way, right? So tell us a little bit about that. Were you doing this before non-fat adapted? And, you know, now you've got your mitochondria used to utilizing fat, which is definitely a better fuel to go on and on. Tell that evolution.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey, no doubt. I started ultra running on very much a stereotypical endurance athlete diet protocol, primarily carbohydrate. You know, not, I wouldn't say like no or low fat approach, but it was definitely one of the minority macronutrients. It was dwarfed by the carbohydrate consumption for sure. Yeah. And then at the end of around 2011, I started kind of experimenting with using fat as my primary fuel source. Mm-hmm. And since then, you know, I've been really fortunate to have guys like Dr. Volek and Dr. Finney kind of to bounce questions off of and stuff like that. And it really just, for me, it was like, I've always been a big fan of self-experimentation. I like that part of it. That's just as intriguing as kind of the competition itself for me. So kind of, kind of finding like what works for me and what works for my lifestyle. Because one of the biggest things I've noticed over the last 5 years is that lifestyle plays a huge role in like what high fat means to you. And for me, you know, with peak training and then recovery, my day-to-day life doesn't look the same every day. So kind of finding out like what windows of high fat work at what times and when is the best time to use one approach and when's the best time to use another approach to maximize performance is key. Because, you know, someone who's taking on a high fat or a ketogenic protocol just for health purposes, or if they're sick or something like that, it looks a lot different than someone using it to try to, you know, run 100 miles. So I always try to emphasize that because people oftentimes assume like it's kind of a template that can just be plugged in for anyone, but you know, a lot of other variables need to be considered.
Yeah, and for a lot of our, you know, clients, and we have a lot of doctors that watch the show, we move them in and out of ketosis. I refer to diet variation because there's a benefit we've learned by moving in and out of different diets, even seasonally, even weekly, for goodness sakes, you know, having higher carb days to, you know, get your insulin to, you know, respond, you know, in a better direction oftentimes. But, you know, I mean, when you're dealing as an athlete, I mean, look, I can go out and I don't have to eat breakfast. I intermittent fast every day. So I can get out, I can ride 3-4 hours on my bike, and I do just fine without eating, and then I come home and eat, right? And people find that fascinating, especially the higher carbers that I ride with who are eating the whole time I'm riding. All right, that's a 3-4 hour ride. I mean, I'm fat adapted. I can go out and ski all day and eat dinner and I'm fine, right? And I don't bonk at all. But we're talking about 100 miles. I mean, okay, so you have to eat during this 100-mile race. You know, I mean, what are you eating? You know, what's the formula, man? I mean, that's, you still have to eat.
Yeah. It's been something I've experimented with a little bit, and I've had coaching clients and friends do it differently than me and have success as well. But for me, what I found is, before when I was high carb, I was eating, you know, upwards to 400, maybe even 500 calories an hour in some of these events. Admittedly, I hadn't done any 100-milers yet at that point. So like I was able to finish within kind of a 5 to 7 hour window because they were more like 50-mile type endeavors. And, you know, so you can kind of hit your stomach pretty hard for that long. But from what I read is when most people are running into trouble from a digestive standpoint, it was in those like 10th, 11th, 12th plus hour range where they'd been hitting their stomach with gels and sugars all day long. And then all of a sudden, especially in the heat, they'd start to reject it. So, as I kind of moved towards, trying out 100-mile distance stuff, I started looking at that as more of a preventative type of move. And, you know, now I've gotten that down to even in some of the, shorter, faster ultra marathons where I'm still kind of in like a much lower carbohydrate feed than I was previously. I've cut that by more than half, and it's usually between maybe 150 and 250 calories an hour. And then it's interesting because the 100 milers actually require less because I'm going at a lower intensity. So if I go into that event really fat adapted, then, you know, I can rely more on fat. And, you know, even at your leanest state, the leanest athletes, you know, have enough body fat to get them through a long event like that. You know, especially with when you put into consideration whatever glycogen stores they had and anything they're eating along the way. Like, they've got plenty of body fat. The fuel tank is much larger than your glycogen reserves. So what I'll do is I try to eat as little as possible without sacrificing performance. And the reason for that is because I see eating as an extra variable. It's another task I'm giving my body. So if I can get away without eating something, then I want to do that because it's going to require less blood diverted to my stomach for digestion, right. Which is another reason why I really don't eat a whole lot of fat while I'm doing these events either. Yeah. I would probably do it differently if I'm getting into like the 24 hour plus range. But you know, I see, like, if I'm going to burn fat, I may as well burn body fat during the event because that's bypassing the digestive tract. So then that just basically leaves carbohydrates. I use them sparingly, but I do use them in events. I'll trickle them in kind of throughout at, like what I said before, that kind of 150 to 250 calorie per hour range. And then just really stay on top of hydration and electrolytes. So that's kind of the game plan heading into most of those things.
Yeah, I would think the electrolytes play a big deal. You know, and for our viewers and listeners, when we talk about fat adapted, you know, we really mean that our mitochondria get so efficient at using mostly fat for energy that we're able to go longer periods without relying on our glucose stores and our glycogen stores. And, you know, the body does become much more efficient. Like I think you said, going into it, if you go into it very fat adapted, then your body just is so efficient at using its body fat, which someone would look at you or me and say, you don't have body fat. We have body fat. Probably 50,000 calories stored of body fat on either one of us. You know, and that's what you want to burn. I was going to say that. I knew that you probably weren't eating a bunch of fat during the race because that would definitely bloat you perhaps and, you know, just be more effort to break down than a simple sugar. So just by eating 150 to 250 calories an hour, your body's still relying on its fat to get the majority of the energy, but you're relying on that just to help, you know, supplement it, I guess.
Yeah. Cause, you know, there is, you know, I look at carbohydrates kind of the same way I would caffeine. It's, something that is definitely a performance boost. But there's a fine line between too much and the right amount. So you want to keep your body sharp. So what I found is by training, in a state where fat is the majority of my macronutrient from a day-to-day standpoint, it gives my body the sensitivity needed to kind of make carbohydrate work kind of as a rocket fuel. So when I do take it, it's very effective.
Yeah. No, I find the same thing. If I do use a carbohydrate like that, like if I'm out really long, it's like wham, you know, I mean, your body, it is like rocket fuel. That was a good analogy. So, you know, it's remarkable because, you know, understanding that the human body can go that long. I read history about the American Indians, and I had recently read, you know, the Wyoming Indians and how they would become fat adapted, and they would literally chase prey, you know, all day long. I mean, their endurance was incredible. And in the article, in the history, it was really a history piece. It was really because they were fat adapted. So I would have to say, this is nothing new. This has actually been used by ancient cultures. So not to take anything away from you, but it's nothing new.
No, we definitely kind of took a step away from it for a few decades there. And now it seems like we're kind of digging back into it a bit, or at least it's out there and people have some information to go off of if they want to, you know, take on the approach.
Yeah. But let me tell you something from a standpoint of health. The most important thing you do, look, these carbohydrate athletes, you know, that are high carbohydrates, they're all getting this point in their life, they start crossing over in their 50s and 60s, and they're developing autoimmune degenerative diseases, inflammatory conditions. You know, even though they stayed thin, they realized that it wasn't healthy. So you can burn all that sugar, but you're really forcing your mitochondria when you're burning sugar. It drives a ton of oxidative stress that really mm-hmm. causes a lot of injury to your DNA. There's something called telomeres. I'm telling the people this, you probably know this, but telomeres are the only biological clock that we know of. And as they shorten, you become closer and closer to death. Endurance athletes get there very quickly. But we used to think it was maybe just from all the endurance. We're really finding out it's really from the driving from the high carbohydrate diets. It definitely shortens your telomeres and shortens your age. So you're an exception. Now we're getting back to these fat adapted athletes. I say you're going to live a normal life.
Yeah, you know, I hope so because like I know for me, like a lot of this stuff with the ultra marathons, it's I very much feel like I've crossed the line of doing it for health standards, and you know, I'm more into the realm of performance, and that's not always good for longevity.
No,
it's not. But you know, it's one of those things too about, you know, enjoying what you're doing while you're here, and rather than kind of asking what if for an extended amount of time. You know, with that said though, I want to prolong my existence as long as possible, and that's definitely part of the reason why I take the high fat approach as opposed to a really, really high carbohydrate approach, beyond the fact that I believe it's actually a performance benefit for me to keep macronutrients from the fat sources at the highest part of my nutrition.
I believe there's no doubt of performance benefits, but for me, there's a massive health benefit. I think it's going to keep you alive. So, all right, Meredith, I think you might have some questions. I'm going to end up going down the training route. I want to know how you train for an ultra marathon. But before I leave this topic of fat, I know she is the fat queen. She's going to ask you questions.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm curious too. So what were some of the differences you noticed when you switched over from relying on carbs for fuel to kind of more so being fat adapted? What were some of the differences and the benefits you've noticed?
So some of the benefits were actually more along the lines of like quality day-to-day life stuff, which I think translates heavily towards training and racing, because so many of those variables play a role in your preparation and your mental state leading into an event. But I know when I first started doing ultra marathons and I was on a higher carb diet, I had done a block of 50 milers where I ran 350 mile races in about a 9-week time frame at the end of 2011, and I did that on a high carb approach. I trained for it on a high carb approach. And you know, I was training very high volume at the time, where I was my peak weeks were, you know, up above 150 miles, and I was averaging well over 100 miles a week throughout the course of the year. So I was definitely putting my body through the gauntlet. And I started to notice, especially like when I factored in work, I was a full-time teacher at the time. When I factored in work and stuff like that, it became incredibly difficult to sleep through the night. I would notice a lot more like water retention in like my ankles and swelling in my legs after hard efforts that took a lot longer to go away. Post race, you know, like it would take me a lot longer to kind of feel like I had that pop back in my legs. You know, some like things that weren't necessarily ideal from either a performance or a health standpoint. So I kind of saw myself at kind of a crossroads where I needed to either revisit what I was doing from an athletic standpoint and whether that was worth the potential health risk, or look at changing some of the stuff I was doing in order to make what I was trying to do more sustainable. And the first thing I kind of came upon was a higher fat approach. So I kind of went through some basic processes with that, where I, you know, in the early stages, I kind of just flipped my macronutrients on their head. So if I had been doing like 60 to 65% carbohydrate, I instead did 60 to 65% fat. And then if I had been doing like 10 to 20% fat, I flipped the carbohydrates towards that. And when I did that, I noticed like right away, that I was sleeping better, you know, like, inflammation and like swelling was going away like almost immediately. That didn't take like a transition at all. That all happened almost immediately. Like they talk about the transition phase and how it can be very difficult, and it's one of the reasons people kind of bail on the program. And I very much did have a transition period where I wasn't able to do fast workouts or anything like that. And for me, rather than being like continuous for 3-4 weeks, it was kind of like I'd have like a handful of days in the week where I felt really groggy, and then a couple days where I felt good. But then after about 3-4 weeks of that, the switch kind of flipped, and I felt like really strong all the time, and I was able to kind of ramp up intensity a bit in my training to go along with some of those health benefits that I was seeing along the way too.
That's awesome. Who won the Western States? The Western States 100. Did you do that one this year?
So the Western States was my first 100 miler that I did. And I did in 2012. I haven't done it since then, but I am going back this year. So
you won in 2012, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I was, in 2012, I was 14th place at Western States. It was very much a learning experience, though. I actually got in like 5 weeks before the event by winning what they call a golden ticket race, where if you finish in the top two, you get an automatic bid. And I really had no ambition of doing 100 miles at the time, but everyone told me you don't pass up on a chance to run Western States. So I jumped at that opportunity and went into it and learned a lot, no doubt.
Who is the guy? He's won a few of them that adapted as well, isn't he?
Oh yeah. So you're thinking of Tim Olson. Yeah. Tim Olson won it in 2012 and 2013 and set the course record in 2012. And yeah, he did it in a fat adapted program as well. So he's got kind of an interesting story where the year before he won it, actually, I believe it was sixth place, but he got sixth place there. And I think in the last, like, 20, 25 miles, he probably stopped, that many times to use the bathroom because his body was just rejecting the fuel he was putting in. And I think that's kind of was the catalyst for him switching. He was looking at a way to make that, in his mind, he's like, if I can eliminate all these unnecessary stops, I could win this thing. And he did, and he ended up winning it twice. So,
Have you ever gone up against Tim Olson? I mean, you guys ever?
So I raced him in 2012 and he kicked my butt at Western States. I raced him at Ice Age 50 mile earlier that year where I had beaten him. But yeah, I think those are the only two times I've raced him. Tim is very much a mountain runner. And the last couple of years I've been doing a lot more flatter track road type stuff. So kind of like I was saying before, there's such a huge emphasis on the specificity of the training where you could have guys who are both super fit, and if one's training the mountains, one's training on the roads. If you race on the roads, the guy training on the roads is going to have a huge advantage, where if you run in the mountains, then the guy training the mountains is going to have a huge advantage. So especially as the sport's gotten more competitive, the last couple of years there's been a lot of talent come into the sport, and that's resulted in just that much more emphasis on specifying on the course you're planning to try to nail.
Yeah. I'm just so fascinated by all of this. And I'm wondering, Zach, if you could kind of take us through a day, or I don't know if you have a typical day, but what that looks like as far as what you're eating and your training and just kind of how it all goes, if you can kind of give us an overview of what it's like a day in the life.
Yeah. Yes. So the mapping of my training and the mapping of my diet actually kind of work hand in hand, in the sense that when I explain it to people, I explain them with the same concept where it's like a periodization. So my training operates on a periodized type of schedule where when I pick a race I want to kind of really nail, I start with a base block where I'm doing a lot of like what we'd call zone one, zone two work, where it's just building miles, building volume, kind of getting that aerobic base developed. And then I'll start adding some workouts, usually more tempo progression based, where I'm not hitting like that anaerobic like zone quite yet, but I'm definitely pushing my body a little harder than I would like in a base building phase. And then I'll drop in some speed workouts, like what you traditionally see on like 400 repeats on a track or 200 repeats on a track or something like that. So depending on where I'm at in my training will depend a lot on what I'm doing. So to match that with the nutrition, the way I do it is when I'm recovering is when I utilize like a ketogenic approach. That's when I'm trying to kind of get my body to completely reset, recover, and just to completely remind it that fat is definitely its primary fuel source. So those are the days where, like, if you looked at my nutrition plan, it would look very ketogenic. It would look like something right out of a textbook from Dr. Volek or Dr. Finney. And then as I start building up my miles, my base miles and stuff, and getting more volume, I'll start to reintroduce a little more carbohydrate, a ton during base phase, because I'm not doing anything super intense. So I'm still metabolizing such a high level of fat at that point. There's just not as much of a need to replace the carbohydrate. But when I do get into the higher volume plus intensity phases, and a lot of times that means a two-a-day workout, that's when I'll start bringing carbs back at the highest level they'll be in my training. And usually that fits within a window of around 15 to, at the most, probably 30% of my intake. So it's still a minority in my macronutrient profile. I'm still taking in easily, you know, 60 to 65% of my calories from fat, even in those peak training blocks. But what I find is when I enter those high intensity, high volume phases in a very fat adapted state, that I can get all the performance benefits I need from that, you know, 15 to 30% carbohydrate window. Whereas someone who's carb dependent is probably going to need to ramp that way up to like 65, 70, or, you know, you read about some guys even going like 80% carbohydrate to meet those energy demands.
Wow, that's incredible. Basically, you're doing something that we teach, you know, your diet variation. You know, there's times where he's utilizing higher carbs, times he's using lower carbs. We do that to get sick people well, and you're doing it for performance, ironically enough.
It's all about matching lifestyle with nutrition, I think. You know, if there's one thing that I've learned, it's that there's just like tons of different quote unquote healthy nutritional approaches. And no matter which one you pick, like there's going to be some study or some, you know, some like educated individual promoting it. And really it's about kind of keeping an open mind and being willing to try for yourself. Like if things aren't working, you don't want, that's not the time to be bullheaded. That's the time to experiment, find something different, change some things, and see if you can make improvements. And for me, that's been very much following a higher fat approach throughout my training. And then, like I said before, the recovery phases are where I'll use what people call a ketogenic diet. And then high intensity, high volume training is where I call it higher fat, just because it's confusing to some people, I think, because, you know, if I run a good race, you know, the folks who are very, very, you know, into the ketogenic approach are really, they're striving to point to someone as look, it works. And then the folks who are on a high carb approach, that they'll want to argue, because they'll say, well, he's not following 50 grams or less a day. So like you get in this gray area, I guess, and it's hard to define.
But that's ridiculous, because when you're putting in that many miles, I have athletes, and including myself, when I'm doing a lot of cycling and training, I can be in ketosis. It's 75 and 100 grams of carbs. You know, it's like, yeah. I mean, it's completely changing, you know, changes from winter to summer for me. So I can get away with a lot more carbohydrates in the summer. So anyways, yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree. I couldn't agree more. You know, it's just remarkable, you know, that what the body can do, you know, and the efficiency, you know, because your body's carrying that efficiency over, like you said. I mean, when you're entering in, even to eating higher carbs or, you know, whatever, it's still low carb, you know, but higher carbs, your body's still carrying that efficiency of fat burning into that time. And that's what makes it work.
And the key is too, like, you know, I can't stay at my peak. I can only get to my peak a couple times a year without like burning myself out. So When I get to the peak and I'm using more carbohydrates, that's a limited time frame. So as soon as that time frame is over and it's time to recover and reset, that's when I can kind of remind my body and, you know, go back to that ketogenic mapping type approach.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the American Indians in the summer, they would go on a higher carbohydrate diet, right? I mean, they would eat more berries and root vegetables, you know, but again, in the wintertime, I mean, they were back into, you know, ketosis. How many hours a day do you have to train for a 100-mile race? Now, I know it changes. I know the base phase is longer, but I mean, give us an idea.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting, and it's hard to kind of put an exact number because for me, I like if I enter a high training block, I don't necessarily try to match my energy demands within that block. I go into it assuming I'm going to run a calorie deficit, and what that ends up doing is I end up leading out a bit during that phase, and then when I'm in my recovery block, I can kind of put some of that back on if I want to. So sometimes it doesn't, the numbers don't range quite as much as they could if I would match macro, if I'd match like energy demands for the exact expenditure of that day. With that said, you know, it's, there's workouts I'll do that demand 5,000-6,000 calories of energy expenditure. I'm in a training block at the moment where I'm going to hit pretty close to 140 miles this week with some intensity in there. So like, you know, there'll be days this week where I'll easily burn 5,000 calories. And then like, I probably won't quite eat that many on that day. But then if I take a recovery day the following day, I'll eat a little more than what I would need typically on a day like that. So, I mean, I find that really intriguing because a lot of folks are, you know, they're working out for health. They're working out to feel good, you know, or because someone told them to. And for folks like that, it's like, you know, they pretty much want to kind of end up in a window of nutrients in order to maintain like a healthy body weight and stuff like that. And they can stick to a little more of a equivalent day-to-day approach. But yeah, it's I feel like I've gotten to the point too where I don't really count calories too much. I'll count in the sense where I kind of know like this is the window of carbohydrate I need and I'll make sure I get that in. And then everything after that, I just kind of go by feel. Like if I'm hungry, I'm going to eat. If I'm not, I'm not going to force it. And yeah, yeah. And your body, when you get really dialed in, you find what works for you. Your body is very good at telling you what you need. So I try to do that. Like, you know, if I have a couple of really good training days and all of a sudden I feel flat the next day, you know, that could be my body telling me that I need to start catching up a bit on some of my energy demands. And, you know, I'll take a slightly easier day and make sure I get some really good meals in that day. And then usually the next day I've got that high energy back again. So your body definitely does a good job of mapping it if you let it. So it's kind of it's the way I like it too. I'd rather have that than have to like, you know, meticulously count everything and plan everything out like that. So,
what's your hours, you know, a day, you know, working out, and do you cross train? Do you do some lifting? You would have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I've done, a decent amount of cross training, I guess, from the strength standpoint or the mobility side of things, more so recently with the mobility stuff, but I've always been like a fan of weightlifting. So just cause I've enjoyed it. More recently I've tried to kind of structure that to be more specific towards what I'm doing. So I'll do a lot of posterior chain work, like deadlifting and, kettlebell swing type stuff, for weightlifting, a lot of core strengthening stuff to kind of keep form and posture in a good spot. And then I'll do, a lot of mobility sessions where, I use a program called MAPS Prime. And it's a full on like mobility, like you identify where your weaknesses are from head to toe. And then once you identify your weaknesses, you put a little extra work into those and your strengths, you do stuff to maintain it. And it just kind of really keeps everything humming and everything in place. And, you know, sometimes, you know, people think of those mobility stretches sometimes as just like not a strength training thing, but I'll tell you the first time I went through the MAPS Prime program, I was sore the next day and I was kind of laughing to myself. I was like, well, here I am able to run 100 to sometimes 150 miles in a week and not get that sore doing it. And then I do this stretching routine, which is what, how most people would define it. And I'm sore from it. So there's definitely benefits to it from both mobility and just an adaptation type of thing too. But yeah, so in terms of hours, you know, I probably put in, but when I'm peak training, I probably put in close to 20 hours a week when you add up all the running hours and the maintenance hours and the cross training type stuff all together.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that I would expect that. Maybe I expected more, you know. Just are you married? Do you have children?
The thing is, I'm very consistent about it, though. So, like, I come from the camp where, like, the consistency over a long period of time is gonna provide the biggest bang for its buck. So, like, for me, like, every year I'll run over 5,000 miles. So even when I'm in low training mode, you know, I'm still moving a lot. I'm still running. It's just the intensity changes quite a bit. And then sometimes the strength training will become a higher emphasis and require more time, or the mobility will become a higher emphasis and require more time. But throughout the course of the year, I'm always kind of up in that, like, I'm moving a lot. And, you know, I'm real fortunate that, you know, my employer, Ultra Footwear, they are really flexible about the way I plan my own schedule. So I can kind of, like, set things up the way I need to prioritize those type of stuff. But yeah, it's, you know, you'll see other folks who'll do it differently. They'll take, like, a big chunk of time of downtime where they're doing very little, and they'll do these big blocks where they're hitting 30 plus hours a week, especially triathletes.
Right.
But when it comes to running, you know, there's so much impact with running. There's almost a point at which you're doing too much damage than good. So yeah. And when I'm in my peak phases too, when I'm running the most miles, I'm getting pretty fit at that point. And a lot of my miles will come in at, like, a low 6 to mid 6 minute mile range. So, I mean, I can go out for a 2.5 hour run and have almost, 22, 23, even close 25 miles in already at that point. So, some of it is that too. Like, if you look at time spent and distance covered, it can range quite a bit throughout your training and throughout your fitness levels.
Yeah, I just find it, like, hard. You can never train, you know, 100 miles. You know, I mean, you can't just run 100 miles and all of a sudden you're out running 100 miles. So how do you train for 100 miles? You can't run 100 miles. You know, it's like, there's a disconnect.
Yeah. And there's definitely like your very peak week. And, you know, I'm always careful to use that as the focal point, just because then people assume that that's what you're doing every week. But I mean, there's certainly weeks where, like, if I enter a 50 miler as a training run and I don't taper for it, I'm probably going to hit close to 30 hours of training that week. But it balances itself out then, because the next week I'm probably going to be going a little lower on the lower side of things when I'm coming back from that. But it's an interesting lifestyle, no doubt.
Wow. I'm amazed that you run 5,000 miles a year. That is just still in my head. But I'm wondering too, do you ever use exogenous ketones or any special support supplements to maintain?
No, not really. I helped out a company with some information with an exogenous ketone supplement, but I haven't done any, like, regular training or racing with any of that. And some of that's just, you know, ketosis isn't my goal. My goal is performance. So, like, I don't necessarily feel like whether I'm knowing where I'm at in ketosis is all that important. You know,
ketones or anything like that, or your blood sugar.
Oh, you know, I'll get tested every once in a while, more often than not, because of, like, a study or something like that. Or, like I was saying before, if I'm testing something, but not often enough to know, like, regular values. You know, one interesting thing that we noticed when I was part of the FASTER study that Dr. Volek put on at the University of Connecticut. That was, I guess, almost 3 years ago at this point, but a lot of the information has more recently been released or approved. And, you know, it, I suspect that training like I am, or any of those subjects that we're training at that study, when you look at like their millimoles of ketones, I suspect it's different. I suspect like that there's different things occurring that are causing those numbers not to mean the same thing as if you would measure someone who's much more sedentary, just like eating like a really low carbohydrate diet. With that said, you know, I've tested myself often enough to know that like I do enter ketosis periodically throughout my training. And I've tested enough to know that I'm not in it all the time either. So, yeah, for me, it's more like if I'm feeling good and training's going well, and the way I'll gauge it is if I can go out for a long run in a fasted state or at a very low nutrient state and feel strong the whole time or finish strong, I know I'm fat adapted enough to have that advantage be there. And some of that kind of happens too. Like when I train, I do the bulk of my work in the morning. So I'll wake up in the morning and I'll have some coffee with maybe a little bit of coconut or almond milk and maybe a very little bit of raw honey. But really it's more often than not, probably 20 to 30 grams of energy at most. And then I'll go out and I'll train hard for a couple hours, sometimes over 3 hours. And at that point, if I slept 8, 9, 10 hours the night before and ate dinner at a normal time, by the time I get back, you know, I've metabolized enough calories to have, you know, almost put together like a fast of over 24 hours. So I think just by that lifestyle, you get really fat adapted. You know, a lot of people will do like a 16 hour fast on a more daily or a 14 hour fast on a more daily routine. I guess I kind of fit in that window where I eat the bulk of my calories probably especially in the winter, within an 8 hour period of time. And then, you know, I'm sleeping a huge chunk of that 16 hours, and then I'm training another huge chunk of that 16 hours. So like, that's really just the window I kind of have. And like I was saying before, like, I don't like to eat when I'm training. I don't even like to drink when I'm training if I don't have to. That's why I love winter running sometimes, because it's cool enough where I can get away with that. But yeah, so for me, I would just prefer to head out with an empty stomach and keep it that way throughout the workout. And then when I get back, you know, prepare some food.
Gosh, I'm the same as you. I prefer to drink a bunch of water when I'm done, you know? go in hydrated and finish after. And I'm not a big, you know, I go, oh, these guys are drinking fluid. It's like, for me, it's just making my body work somewhere else, man. I want the energy in my, you know, in my muscles, you know. It's like, it's not like I'm going to dehydrate that quickly. If I'm on a very long ride, I sip water, right? I mean, I'm sure.
Right.
Well, but like you, I try to minimize it, you know. I eat when I'm done, you know. It's like, but I eat in a window, just like you. You know, days I work out a lot, my window broadens a little bit. You know, I eat a little sooner. Days I don't work out, or like this morning I worked out, but it wasn't that hard. I haven't eaten yet today, and it's 3:30 my time almost, you know. Sure. So, but, you know, if I did a bike ride, I would have eaten by now. I would have been maybe a shorter window, maybe a 14, 15 hour window. But it's amazing. We're doing it for different reasons. You know, I'm doing it for health reasons. You're doing it performance reasons, but I do it partly for performance too. I'm just not competitive like you are.
Well, and the really intriguing thing to me is like, because a lot of people, I think, will go into it and they'll very much like plan it out, where like they draw this line in the sand where I'm not going to eat before this time, and I'm not going to eat, or I'm going to stop eating at this time. And for me, it just kind of happens that way. Like, I'm not trying to go for a 16 hour fast. You know, I've done intentional fasts in the past. More so during recovery than during hard training. But it just kind of, that's just the way that I feel the most dialed in. It just kind of works itself out that way. And, that's the key for me, is like when things are happening just naturally like that, and I'm not trying to do anything contrived is when I kind of feel like things are working and my body's working for me, not against me.
Yeah, you know, it's less stressful. I probably 3 times a week will fast dinner to dinner, 24 hours. It's never planned, Zach. Never. It's mm-hmm. about my busy days. I get busy going, and all of a sudden I realize, you know, it's 6 o'clock. I haven't eaten. I just fast. I didn't even know. Happened yesterday. I didn't plan on fasting all day. I just did. So I never got hungry. I'm fat adapted. So I just went all day. And then sure enough, I feasted, about 6 o'clock. But that's the way I am too.
And it is the most natural way, but there, of course, is that time period in the beginning as well when you're not fat adapted that, you know, it can be really uncomfortable and you need to just kind of you go through that period too while you're training, you know, your cells to burn your own fat for energy to kind of get to that place where you can really trust, you know, your intuition and just eating when you're hungry. Because I think it is important to note that there is that period where maybe you can't always totally trust your cravings or when to eat, until you kind of become fat adapted. And then, your hunger signals, are just kind of much more regulated and, you know, kind of more natural.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, well, now that's, thank you. I appreciate it. I mean, every bit of information I know our viewers and our listeners are just absorbing because we have many that watch and listen that do what you do. Not to run 100 miles. I still find that absolutely fascinating. I find it fascinating why anyone would want to run 100 miles. It's like, that's incredible. I mean, that's like, oh my gosh, I'm a cyclist, right? It's like running 5 miles to me is just like drudgery. Cycling, at least there's some speed and some action. But anyways, not to take away from what you do, because I love what you do. I love extraordinary people that do extraordinary things. And man, that's you. So take my hat off to you, no doubt.
As silly as it sounds, I think like running 100 miles kind of happens accidentally. Like, I remember when I was a sophomore in college and I decided to try out for the cross country team, and I was talking to the coach and, you know, he kind of outlined what most of the guys were doing throughout the course of their collegiate career. And it basically started out with freshmen would do about 50 miles a week, and, you know, seniors would get up to 90, sometimes 100 mile weeks when they were base training. And I remember thinking distinctly, like, I will never run 90 miles in a week in my life. And, you know, here we are today, and like, I'm doing that stuff in a day. So yeah. It's weird how that kind of like grows on you, and you get curious and you try another, and you end up running 100 miles.
Just end up running 100 miles. I don't know if many can say that, but hey, hats off to you for sure, Zach. And you're definitely an inspiration. So
what's your website?
Yep.
Yeah, my website is zachbitter.com. That's Zach with a C-H, Z-A-C-H-B-I-T-T-E-R. That's where like most of my contact info and stuff is, social media as well. I'm fairly active on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. So if folks have questions or want to connect in any way, those are good spots to kind of reach out.
Awesome. Great. Thank you, Zach.
Hey, thanks so much, Zach. Thank you, Dr. Pompa. And Dr. Jeff Volek was mentioned in this episode as well. So we interviewed him in episode 104. If you guys want to check that out, that was a great interview as well. So I wanted to add that in. But thanks again, Zach. You guys should definitely connect with him on social media. Check out his website. And thanks for watching, everybody. And we'll see you next time. Have a great weekend.